Natural forces within us are the true healers of disease, Hippocrates. Stay tuned and find out your most powerful tool when it comes to mastering your metabolism at midlife with Dr. William Lee.
So the big question is, how do women over 40 like us keep weight off, have great energy, balance our hormones and our moods, feel sexy and confident, and master midlife? If you're like most of us, you're not getting the answers you need and remain confused and pretty hopeless to ever feel like yourself again. As an OBGYN, I had to discover for myself the truth about what creates a rock-solid metabolism, lasting weight loss, and supercharged energy after 40 in order to lose 100 pounds and fix my fatigue. Now, I'm on a mission. This podcast is designed to share the natural tools you need for impactful results and to give you clarity on the answers to your midlife metabolism challenges. Join me for tangible natural strategies to crush the hormone imbalances you're facing and help you get unstuck from the sidelines of life. My name is Dr. Kieran Dunstan. Welcome to the Hormone Prescription Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Hormone Prescription with Dr. Kieran. Thank you so much for joining me as we dive in with Dr. William Lee to talk about Eating to Beat Disease. Eat to Beat Disease is the name of his New York Times best-selling book on the new science of how your body can heal itself. He also has another book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, Burn Fat, Heal Your Metabolism, and Live Longer. Needless to say, he is an expert when it comes to what to eat, how to eat, when it comes to improving your health. And he is super passionate about food. He loves to cook like I do. So we had a really great conversation. I think you're going to enjoy. He's going to talk a little bit about the quote from Hippocrates that I shared with you in the teaser, and also another one from Bruce Lee, and another one about what discovery actually consists of and how it can help you when it comes to creating great health. I'll tell you a little bit about Dr. Lee, and then we'll get started. Dr. William Lee is a medical doctor and internationally renowned physician, scientist, and author of the New York Times bestseller, Eat to Beat Disease. His groundbreaking research has led to the development of more than 40 new medical treatments that impact care for more than 70 diseases, including diabetes, blindness, heart disease, and obesity. His TED Talk, Can We Eat to Starve Cancer?, has garnered more than 11 million views. Dr. Lee has appeared on Good Morning America, CNN, CNBC, Rachel Ray, and Live with Kelly and Ryan. He's been featured in USA Today, Time Magazine, The Atlantic, O Magazine, and more. He is president and medical director of the Angiogenesis Foundation, and he's leading global initiatives on food as medicine. And he has a new book, New York Times bestseller, Eat to Beat Your Diet, about burning fat, healing your metabolism, and living longer. And it was released in March of 2023. This is a super fangirl moment for me because Dr. William Lee is amazing, personable, passionate. I think you're going to love him as much as I do. Please help me welcome Dr. William Lee to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dunst. It's a real pleasure.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you here. I heard you speak at a conference a few years ago, and I thought to myself, oh, I want to have him on the podcast. That would be amazing. And you're very in demand, so I think it took me this long to be able to get you on the show. But I'm super honored to have you here. Your books have transformed so many people's lives and really helped to move forward people's level of understanding about their diet, what they're putting in their mouths, and their health, the outcomes they're getting. So I'm very curious, as a traditionally trained physician, how did you come to become so passionate and knowledgeable about eating to beat disease?
Well, you know, those of us who trained in traditional medicine know how little nutrition actually is taught in medical school or during training. And that's certainly true in my own education. I had I had some secret sauce that I brought into the equation before I went to med school. I studied biochemistry in college, and afterwards I did a gap year. And during my gap year, before going to medical school, I traveled to the Mediterranean. I lived in Italy and I lived in Greece. And my interest all the way back then was in studying the interconnections between diet culture and health. And what really interested me, and this is, again, long before I went to med school, I was curious about how these cultures in Italy and Greece developed their food traditions and the seasonal eating that they did using whole plant-based foods primarily, long before these terms became popular, and how much it meant to them culturally. In other words, people are eating, the children were eating what the parents were eating, who cooked what the nonas or the grandmas were eating. And they passed these traditions and recipes down. And it's been going on for hundreds of years. And that was really interesting to me because of my own background being Asian American. I grew up with cultural legacies that came from my own family. And we saw lots of things mixing together, but I was always very curious about that link. And of course, being in the Mediterranean, I got to see people viewing food not out of fear, which is what we so often encounter. Oh, I don't know what I should eat. Should I be fearing saturated fat? Should I be fearing dairy? Should I be fearing soy? I saw something completely different. And what I saw was people approaching food with joy. When people in the Mediterranean sat down for a meal, they usually sat down with company. And when they were, and the conversation they had, inevitably, when they were eating together, was about the food that was placed in front of them and its tastes and the seasonality and how their mothers prepared or how their spouses would prepare the foods at home. And it made me realize, as I then in a later went to medical school, by contrast, how absent the idea of food and health in our culture and American culture was. And so I could never forget that. And as I memorized bugs and drugs, as you know, from medical training, and as I observed all the terrible, crappy food and lifestyle, the diet and lifestyle of the medical student and the resident was just so terrible, I started to realize that there clearly was a missing piece of what modern doctors are trained on. And I think that the tide is changing a little bit, but hear me out for a second. What was missing was really the toolbox of the medical community. Before 1930, we had no antibiotics. We had no fancy drugs. You know, doctors going back in the beginning of the 1900s and going back thousands of years really only had what was in a natural world and food and lifestyle as our only tools. And somehow in those last, you know, let's say 90 years, 100 years or so, we lost sight of the fact that food is a tool in our toolbox. And so we're training doctors to practice with inventions, medications, surgery and radiation and all this other kind of stuff. And we've forgotten our roots. And the roots of the food being a tool in the toolbox is so important because we now have the science. And I'm a scientist. I'm an internal medicine doctor trained for you know, young and old, men and women, healthy and sick. And I realized the huge, wonderful opportunity was for people who had the scientific knowledge like me to do the deep dive, kind of like I could dive into the mosh pit of food using the same scientific rigor that we use for drug development to try to understand why foods are good for us. We know they taste good. Now we have a better understanding of why they're actually beneficial as well. So I'm all about what foods to add and the new knowledge coming out of that, rather than what foods to avoid, although obviously there are some foods that one should avoid as well.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, as you were speaking, a couple things came to mind. I recently watched a British series that was, I think, took place in the 1800s. And whenever somebody felt ill, they gave them bone broth. They didn't call it bone broth, but they called it broth. Yeah. And so exactly what you're saying is something that I've observed. And, you know, chicken soup, where does that come from? It's broth. Well, it's bone broth. And then what you shared about traveling to Italy, I had the pleasure of traveling to France with Walter Ouellette from Harvard. I think he's the author of, is it The French Paradox?
I know Walter. Yes, very good.
Yeah. And to study why they don't have the cardiac and other diseases that we have based on their diet. And so that was really fascinating. So you just said that picking your food from a joyful place versus a fearful place, which I love, and really focusing on what foods to add. So what has been most surprising to you in the research that you've done in terms of what foods to add?
Okay, so the wonderful thing about being a scientist is that we're always surprised, because we're at, you know, as a scientist, most people think that researchers, scientists spend all their time getting together and dishing brainiac rocket science at each other. But in fact, that's not what we do. So real scientists, when we get together with other scientists, we spend all of our time talking about questions that we don't know the answers to. And so we don't actually talk about what we know, we talk about what we don't know. And so for me, the opportunity to do research on food as medicine is a wonderful opportunity to continuously be surprised by what we're actually discovering. Give me some examples, all right? We know that berries are healthy, right? I mean, colorful berries, eat the rainbow. I love strawberries, I love blueberries, I love blackberries. They're good for us, they're anti-inflammatory. I think most people would actually know that. Okay, well, when I first dove into this food as medicine world, one of the things that I did with colleagues at the U.S. National Cancer Institute, my colleagues were actually doing drug discovery, trying to find new cancer drugs. And so in that process, you have, as a researcher, you're not aware of what you're testing. So they call it blinded or masked. So you have no idea what you're testing, to be objective. And you would throw these chemical powders or liquids into a test system to see if they would starve cancer by cutting off the blood supply. All right, that's what this project was all about. And what I did in what was considered daring back then, I decided to sneak about 20 different food extracts into the system. So maybe there were 50 drugs to test, and I snuck 20 extras. So there were 70 things to test. And literally, we were testing food versus drugs head to head in the same system for cancer discovery and drug development. Okay, cancer drug treatment. I was so surprised to discover that strawberry extracts that contain something called ellagic acid. So you don't have to be a chemist, but just know that people that are doing the research, we're beginning to figure out what these substances are. Ellagic acid is a powerful anti-cancer substance because it cuts off the blood supply that's actually growing that could feed a cancer cell. And we validated and tested this head-to-head with cancer drugs. Okay, now, that was a big surprise. Fast forward to just a couple of weeks ago, I was surprised yet again that other researchers have been studying strawberries, looking at the same types of substances, ellagic acid, and now we know there's another group of compounds called proanthocyanidins. And guess what they've been shown to do in clinical studies? This is a study from the University of Cincinnati where they looked at about 30 people with mild cognitive deficits, so not full-on dementia, but heading in that direction. And they found that one cup worth of strawberries per day over the course of 6 weeks could improve memory and cognitive performance. Amazing. Now, and the same substances. So here it is, you know, strawberries have activity in cancer drug, along the lines of a cancer drug. Strawberries have activities in a clinical study along the lines of helping people who are having cognitive difficulties. If that's not food as medicine, if that's not real research being conducted, I don't know what is. And these are the kinds of surprises that I literally get up out of bed, right? Roll out of bed, and I've got like 1 foot in the past, you know, the same stuff that you and I trained on, Dr. Dunson, you know, the bugs and drugs, as I call them, okay? Right. And the other foot in the future, because this is what we're discovering, how the Mother Nature's pharmacy with a F, not a pH, right. The Mother Nature's pharmacy is more incredible than we ever imagined. And so this is what I think I'm surprised by. Tea, green tea is good for you, but so is a super fermented tea called pu'er tea. Guess what? Pu'er tea is even a probiotic tea that improves metabolism studied in human trials. Amazing. And so I every day am surprised by something, and it makes me smile and it makes me happy to realize that we are able to lean into the foods that we should be adding to our system and learning more about that, and not just vilifying foods, which has been really kind of like the cave we've crawled out of.
Yes. You know, you mentioned pu'er tea, and I call it dirt tea. because it has a different taste. So you have to get used to it. But because of the health benefits, I remember when I first tried it, I didn't care for it. But I said, I'm going to learn to like it because it's good for me. And now I love it. So I think that what are a lot of people's objections to eating in ways that are healthy? You know, I don't know anybody listening, when's the last time they ate a fresh strawberry or a fresh green bean or had something like a poo or tea? But people say it's expensive. They say it's time consuming. It's not convenient. They say it doesn't taste good. So how do you've done this beautiful research and really shown that these foods can help and bring them into your diet, these other foods maybe you want to eat less of, but the practicalities of those cost in terms of time, financial expense, and then also the dislike, how do you help people get past those?
Sure. Okay. So I wrote two books that became New York Times bestsellers, yeah. Eat to Beat Disease and Eat to Beat Your Diet. And one of the things that I did as I wrote each book is I created tables and charts of foods that have been scientifically and clinically shown to be beneficial to help boost your body's health defenses. These foods make you healthier, okay? And the evidence and the science proves it. Okay, so, but I took all the, I did all the heavy lifting for my readers. And so the tables and charts are there. What I tell people to do is if you crack open my books and you just take a photograph screenshot of the tables and charts, and please take a Sharpie or pencil or whatever you're writing with, highlighter, and circle the foods among those 300 that you already like. You know, maybe some people don't like green beans or Brussels sprouts, but maybe they like peaches or maybe like berries. You know, if you start circling these things, I always tell, I have not found anybody over the last 4 years I've challenged that couldn't find something, some foods, in some cases, many foods, what they're circling like crazy. And I said, guess what? You have just won the lottery, the food and health lottery, because you've circled the foods that are already good for you and you like them. You've said that you like them. So if you start eating healthy foods that you already like, you are way ahead of the game because you already like the foods that are good for you. Start with that, go to the grocery store. And so that's one way of actually addressing the like versus dislike. I'm starting with you and I'm trying to find out in a very personal way, what are your taste preferences? Everyone's different. Everyone's got their comfort foods. Everyone, you know, everyone can remember something that mom cooked when we were kids that we actually really resonate with. That's cool because you're almost certainly going to find something that's healthy. Now, that's one thing. What about cost? Look, there was once this idea that you have to eat organic and you have to eat local and you have to eat fancy stuff. Turns out that the research is showing that the dirt cheap stuff, not just dirt tea, but dirt cheap foods are actually good for you. Yeah. Nuts and seeds, you know, walnuts, pecans, almonds, all those kinds of things you can buy in bulk. You know, go to one of those big discount stores and buy them in bulk. Great for our gut health, which then improves our metabolism, helps our fat hormones, helps all kinds of other aspects in our lives, lowers cholesterol. It doesn't have to be expensive. One of the least expensive things I can think of that I actually like and I put into my own shopping cart is not fancy pants at all. I love navy beans, all right? Navy beans, you go to the middle aisle, and you just get a can of this stuff, they're pretty inexpensive. Navy beans have lignans. They've got great soluble fiber. They're super fast, super cheap. Crack a pan, that crack thing over there, rinse them out. Okay, I rinse all that cloudy stuff away from it. All right, stick them in a pot, heat them up, throw some inexpensive herbs that you can get out of your pantry to light it up a little bit. And you got yourself a gut healthy meal that's good for your gut microbiome, shown by evidence that it's not only inexpensive, it actually works to improve your metabolic health. So I think that, you know, if you take a look at healthy food, it's not only for the 1%. I think, in fact, the elemental foods, the things that used to be widely available to everyone, can they actually be really, really healthy, including dried foods, which tend to be healthier. You can store them longer. You can buy them in bulk, and that's totally fine. Here's something a lot of people don't realize. I know that it's true that eating a mostly vegetarian, all vegetarian, you don't have to be vegan, but mostly vegetarian diet is going to be healthier for you. But if you eat seafood, Okay. You don't have to go to the fancy fish market to buy expensive line cut, whatever. Okay. If you go to the middle aisle of the grocery store and you just carefully look for little tins of fish, I'm not talking about cat food. Don't go to the pet food section. Okay. I used to think canned tuna was cat food because it smelled exactly like what we'd feed a cat. But there is in the Mediterranean, there's a long history of tinned foods, tinned sardines, tinned mackerel, tinned tuna. They put a little extra virgin olive oil and they put some spices and herbs. They might put some like piquillo peppers or something in. You can find these in a grocery store and they're not expensive. You can buy a big pack of them. You can put them in a pantry. And man, do they make a tasty omega-3 healthy oil. Not only the omega-3 fats, but also olive oil when they're cooked with that. You can just put that with a piece of crusty sourdough bread and have some raw carrots and you put yourself a real snack, you know, whatever the girl's dinner or the girl's meal, like they talk about. Something like that can be inexpensive and incredibly tasty and healthy for you as well. So I always tell people, don't let price be the obstacle. There's lots of things that are inexpensive that anyone can actually afford. Okay. And then the other issue about convenience. All right. I think that if you look on the internet today, you pick an ingredient, beans, kale, tomatoes, what have you, nuts, tree nuts. And if you want to actually find something, a simple way to do it, you don't need to bust open that old yellowed thick book that your mom used to keep around as a cookbook, right? Passed around for generations. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
All you got to do is to go onto Google, type ingredient, you know, collards or kale, and type recipe and type simple, how about 15 minute, all right, 20 minute, and hit search and click on the video and watch somebody show you how to do it, all right? It's easy to do. And so I think that we should, and by the way, I have to tell you, as somebody who enjoys cooking, I'm not only a scientist and a doctor, I actually love cooking. But to me, it's joyful, it's relaxing. I get some time by myself, I'm creating something. Listen, if that actually fits your personality as well, there's nothing better than knowing that you're eating and feeding your loved ones and your friends and family as something that you put together and you know everything that you put into it. And you can make those decisions for other people and it tastes great. So again, I hear you point out the exact same things that lots of people talk about as obstacles to healthy eating. And from my perspective, they're not really obstacles at all. You just have to look at them in a different way.
I love that answer. And I wholeheartedly agree. I was blessed to be raised by a mother who actually was a trained chef. She trained with Anne-Marie Colvin at the Natural Gourmet Cookery School in New York. And Anne-Marie was one of the pioneers in teaching people how to cook mostly, I don't think she dealt with meat at all, actually. It was vegetarian, healthy, tasty meals. So I learned at a young age how to cook healthy food. Of course, I went off to medical school and I came back and told my mother, "We heal with steel, mother," because I thought I knew better. It wasn't until I had my own health challenges that I went back to her and then really started to pay attention to how does she cook healthy food that is delicious with healthy ingredients and really learn how to do it in an efficient, cost-effective manner.
Yeah.
So I think it's something, it's a skill that anyone can learn. And you describe beautifully.
Absolutely. And you know, listen, if you know how to change a tire in your car or put in or change your oil in your engine, if you know how to fix the gutter, or the drain sink, if you know how to plunge a toilet, you can actually, you're smart enough to know how to actually cook something tasty. And I like I love the idea. I don't know if you're saying healing with steel refers to cookware, but that's another way to think about it. You know, like, look, you don't have to go to the hospital and sit in the waiting room, you know, to be called by the nurse. And I think that there are, look, we're both doctors, and so I'm quite confident that we're on the same page. There are medical issues that you must go to your doctor for and communicate with your doctor for, and that only your doctor can really solve for you because it's not something you can really tackle at home. But on the other hand, health care, and I think you'll agree with me as well, it doesn't happen in the doctor's office or the hospital. health care is what people deliver for themselves between visits to the doctor's office, between visits to the ER, to the hospital, or the infusion clinic, or wherever you're going. You care for yourself. We do medical interventions, you know, in the doctor's office. We can do assessments, but the care for your health is what we do to all of ourselves at home. And food is just, you know, one of the several important things, because obviously we can't just think about this over simply. I mean, you've got exercise, you've got stress management, you've got sleep, socialization, all things that are part of self-care. And look, everybody out there is in the world now, you know, in this new era of self-care, right? Where we know not to overwork ourselves. We know not to overload ourselves at work. Self-care is really sort of is a new era where we are taking responsibility for the amount of stress that we put in ourselves or other people put in ourselves. I think nutrition and eating well, and importantly, eating the things that you like that are healthy, all right? It's got to taste good. That's part of self-care. And it's just another thing to really think about and cultivate for yourself.
Yes, I'm saying that 2024 is the new self-love and self-care. It's like next level. It's time to bump it up a notch and really make self-love an action word. It's a verb, and really meeting your needs and your wants and your desires to a high level, including your diet. I do know that a lot of women listening are dealing with what I call midlife metabolic mayhem, the 60 plus symptoms that women start experiencing over 40. The top two being fatigue and weight gain. So they're going to want to hear something from you about your second book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, how you heal your metabolism, burn fat, and live longer. So can you talk a little bit about the challenges for all of us, but maybe particularly for women over 40 with their metabolism and what's happening there and how they can work with their diet to assist them?
Yeah, well, listen, you know, if you're a woman and you're in the middle of your life and you're struggling with the actual issues or the questions about weight gain, weight management, fatigue, you know, all the things that, well, I think most people recognize, dread, and maybe even accept that they're going to have to contend with as they get into their 40s and 50s and later in their life. I have some good news. First of all, my book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is not a diet book. That's a trick title. It's an anti-diet book. I write a book about how you don't need to go on these intense, crazy diets that might actually help you lose a few pounds, or maybe even more than a few pounds, but you can't stick to. But how you can instead use the latest thinking about human metabolism, about body fat, and the connections to our hormones, or to our energy levels, to our ability to live rich, fulfilling lives in a way that we didn't recognize before. And let me explain this in a way that I think people can understand. All of us probably do something pretty similar, right? You get up in the morning, roll out of bed, take a shower, come out of the shower, and you're drying off, and you probably got a mirror in the bathroom, and out of the corner of your eye, you probably see on your naked body a lump or a bump that you are not happy with. Doesn't matter if you're a big person or a small-bodied person. We all see this stuff, right? And then what's the thing you do? You curse, like, ugh, I don't want to see that. Then the next thing you do is what? Step on the bathroom scale. And if that number that comes up isn't the one that you were hoping for, you curse again, all right? First thing in the morning, you've cursed yourself twice, right? And if this sounds like a familiar story, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think most people resonate with it, because I do the same thing. I used to do the same thing. We kind of associate our weight with our health. We associate body fat with something very negative. And we always talk about like negativity and body fat. Look, it's maybe part of our human nature. I don't care if you're a vegan or not, but if you actually go to a grocery store and you're pushing your cart around, and you're going to be pushing it by the meat section, the butcher section, and you see that gigantic T-bone steak that's got like a thick rind of white fat around it, I don't care if you're like the biggest meat eater in town, everyone goes, ugh, I hope nobody eats that, right? So we're conditioned to think about body fat and the word fat in very negative ways. But what I want to tell people in their middle age is that we don't always think about fat negatively. There's one situation I can tell you, everyone sees fat and smiles And you know what that circumstance is? That's when we see a baby. When we see a pudgy mm-hmm. baby, you know, newborn, 1 year old, big fat cheeks, double chin, roly poly tummy, you know, big fat arms and legs. You're smiling right now, right? I'm not smiling, saying it. That's one situation which fat makes us feel happy. So think about what that means. Somewhere in our brain, we recognize that body fat is actually a good thing. In fact, if you saw a baby that was long and thin, like a fashion model, like a runway model with thin thighs and thin arms, like sharp chiseled cheekbones, you'd be freaked out, right?
You would run the other way.
You would say there's something seriously wrong with that baby, and you'd be completely right. Okay, so to understand body fat and metabolism and hormones in middle age, it's really helpful to go way back and realize what body fat does for us when we're younger. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but our body fat and our hormones are really tightly interconnected. And our body fat and our health, meaning good health, beneficial health, are tightly tied together. All right. Now, I got to explain this. Most people don't know this, but if you go back, Dr. Dunstan, back to med school, you remember we were sitting in embryology class and they were teaching us about how humans form. Dad sperm meets mom's egg and some ball of cells, and we had to memorize all the things that actually happened. Well, when the organs form, all right, one of the first organs that form are blood vessels. And that makes sense because every organ is going to need blood flow to remain alive. The next tissue that really forms are nerves, because that's the electrical system of the house of your body. And we all need electrical wires to power up our organs, all right? A third tissue organ that forms is body fat. Body fat is one of the early first organs that form. And by the way, at this point in our lives, we don't have waistlines. We don't actually have chins yet. We're still kind of forming our overall shape as humans. And you know where the body fat forms is as a ring around blood vessels. So when body fat starts forming, it forms as a cushion around our blood vessels. And you go, why would that be? Why is body fat forming our blood vessels? Well, it turns out, and we now know this, that our body fat, which is sometimes called adipose tissue, so we now call fat tissue, these adipocytes, the cells of fat around are living around blood vessels, because each of these fat cells, adipocytes, are actually fuel tanks for the energy that we need to run our body. And where does the fuel get loaded into the fuel tank? From our blood vessels, because the food that we eat goes into the blood vessel, and the blood vessel loads them into the storage tank, which is our fat cells. And that's why fat starts forming around the blood vessel. So all around our blood vessels, all throughout our body, there's fat that actually starts forming. Now, obviously, the fat forms elsewhere as well, but it shows you just how important body fat is. Now, later in life, as we develop as teenagers, I mean, look, little boys and girls, five-year-olds, seven-year-olds, pretty much they look all the same, right? They have the same body type, but later during adolescence, mm-hmm. puberty, hips form, breasts form, chests form, you know, facial features start reforming as well. That's where the future adult us begins. We start to look like the future adult who we're going to be, and our body composition changes and fat starts moving in different places to where it needs to go. Now, we've got three kinds of fat that form. All right. And I'm telling you this because people who are middle age need to understand fat didn't form because you had too much to eat over Thanksgiving dinner. Okay. Or that you went to that restaurant and you had too much on your plate. This is actually fat that this is healthy fat I'm talking about. There's three types of fat that form even when we're young teenagers and into young adults, you know, kind of best shape of our lives. We've got subcutaneous fat that's under the skin, undercutaneous skin fat. That's kind of like a wetsuit that protects us. That's healthy, helps to shape us. Then you've got visceral fat, which is gut fat, visceral meaning gut, packed inside the tube of our body. So if you think about it, you could have a thin tube or you could have a big tube. People with large bodies have big tubes, but even people who are thin have thin tubes. And the visceral fat grows inside the middle of the tube of the body. You can't see in the mirror. All right. It's not the muffin top. It's not the double chin. It doesn't wobble under your arm. It's deep inside your gut. All right. And you need some of that. And then there's brown fat. And this is something that I think is really interesting. is that brown fat, which we used to only think was in animals and babies, is a thin layer of fat. We're not talking about wiggly, jiggly, wobbly fat. It's not under your arms. Brown fat is quite different. It's paper thin, wafer thin, and it's pressed not close to the skin, but close to the bone, deep in our tissues. We got some of it behind our breastbone. We got some of it around our neck. We got some of it a little bit in our belly, some of it behind between our shoulder blades. Brown fat is like an engine, like the stovetop in your kitchen that uses gas. You want to boil some water? What do? You turn the crank, it goes click, 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 whoosh, you get the flame going on. That's what brown fat does. Brown fat metabolically whooshes, fires up to create heat, right, for our body, and it draws that energy from our white fat, starting with the visceral fat, which our fat controls fat. And what happens, and there's all kinds of hormones that the fat is normally producing. This fat, healthy fat, produces at least 15 different kinds of hormones. Adiponectin is one of them that even helps our body absorb insulin and it helps us release insulin and draw in our glucose so we have energy. So I'm bringing this up because people complain about not having enough energy, all right? Adiponectin gives us our energy because it takes the food that we're eating and stores that energy into our fat cells, all right? And then we burn off that fat cell when we move around. And that's what gives us energy in our brain, in our muscles, everything. Okay, now, what happens is that if you actually overload the body's fat stores, if you overeat, you put too much fuel in your body, like unlike a car where if you put too much fuel in, it just splashes right out of the fuel tank. What does it do? Runs down the side of your car, around the tires, pools around your shoes. Now you're standing in a dangerous, toxic, flammable mess, right? In a gas station. In your body, if we actually overload fuel, okay, by overeating, we just make more fuel tanks, those fuel tanks being fat cells. And so the more we eat, the more fuel we store, the more fuel we store, the more fuel tanks we need, the more body fat we need to make. And that's really why overconsumption of food, good or bad, actually will lead to more body fat being created. And the body fat that gets created, you can see it in the mirror, okay? Those are the lumpy, bumpy things. Or they can actually grow in the center of your body around visceral fat. This is the fat that wraps around all your organs. Dangerous, because when you overeat and you have too much fuel and you've got too much fat wrapped around your organs, that fat becomes starved of oxygen. It becomes inflamed. It's like a forest fire that gets ignited inside your belly. Can't even see it. It's deep inside, and that inflammation rushes out throughout your body. And one thing it does is it inflamed fat upsets it derails the hormones, like the fat hormones, like adiponectin. When that hormone gets derailed, you can't absorb your fuel well. And guess what now? Even though you're loaded with a lot of fuel, you're not using a lot of fuel. You are tired. You're fatigued. So gaining too much weight leads to fatigue. Inflammation accompanies it. All right. So overeating is one of these things that we need to really be careful about. Now, the other thing that happens in middle age, people go, oh, my metabolism is going to slow down. There's something I can do about it. It's my fate, right? And indeed, people's bodies change, women and men, but especially women. I think they notice it a lot more. When your body shape changes, when you hit your mid-40s and into your 50s, oh, you know, I don't know what I can do. And I'm looking just like my mom did, all right? So the fact of the matter, and used to say, I've gained too much weight because my metabolism has slowed down. Nothing I can do about it, right? Wrong. We used to think slow metabolism causes excess body fat, but in fact, it's the other way around. Too much body fat slows down your metabolism. And we know this from a seminal research study that was conducted just in 2021, published in the journal Science, one of the most credible journals in the world, where they found that all humans only undergo four phases of metabolism in their life. And in the middle phase of metabolism, all right, so when you're born, everyone's born with the same metabolism. 1 year old, it shoots straight up. 1 year old to 20 years old, your metabolism comes down to adult level. And then from 20 to 60, this is exactly where middle age occurs, 40, 45, 50, 55. Human metabolism is designed to be rock stable. It is not hardwired to go down. We are not programmed from birth to have a slow metabolism when we hit our middle age. And so anybody listening to this, you got to realize everything that we thought has just been, the story has been changed because we now realize that we are, our bodies are hardwired. It's our birthright to have a normal, stable metabolism in middle age. Only at age 60, 60 to 90, slows down a little bit, okay? But not huge, it slows down a little bit. Now, what happens is that if you gain extra body fat, if you have extra fuel consumed, all right, and you're not moving, and that extra fat causes the inflammation, disrupts the hormones, the fat hormones we're talking about here, you know, adiponectin, ghrelin, I mean, these are all kinds of leptin. These are all hormones that are affected by, that are needed and healthy for us when we have the right amount of body fat and energy. But when we have too much of it, not only does that slow down our metabolism, but the excess inflammatory fat derails our, these hormones. When you derail these hormones, it's literally like taking a train, okay, and just chucking it off the rails. Now, it all heck breaks loose. And now you don't know if you're hungry or not hungry. Oh, maybe I'll just eat some more. No, you know, you're eating more food. Now you're eating more fuel. It's making everything worse. And then it, and the excess body fat slows down your metabolism. So the explanation for people who are reaching middle age to say, I'm fatigued. I'm gaining weight. I don't know what to do. I don't think I have a choice. One of the things that modern research is showing us is that, number one, you can actually try to restore your body's metabolic set point. It might take time to do it, but one thing to do is actually to burn down excess body fat. And to do that, you want to eat less, even intermittently fast, be a good way of doing it. Second, you want to eat good quality food because you don't want to be eating food that's just going to blow up that inflammatory fat. You want to eat good quality food, less of it, stay away from the ultra processed stuff, the added sugars, the added, you know, carbs. Then what you want to do is exercise. You want to stay physically active. You know, a body in motion stays in motion is the old law of thermodynamics or physics. And so you want to actually stay in motion, walking, exercising. You don't need a trainer. You just need to stay active. You're going to be burning down some of that extra fuel. You need good quality sleep because our metabolism burns down extra fuel when we're in REM sleep, good quality sleep. All right. Now, why, by the way, why is all this not happening to us? Why is it so difficult to do this when we are in our mid-40s for women watching this? Think about it, how complicated our lives are at middle age. When you are 20, you know, you might be struggling with various things, ideas, but I mean, it might have seemed like a mountain, but really a molehill compared to what you're dealing with in your 45. Right. All right?
Yes, right. Right.
Okay, so back then you were working out, you were looking good, you were fitting into whatever clothes you wanted, and you had plenty of energy, and you know, you could do whatever you wanted, and you didn't seem to gain weight, but you were active, all right? Now, fast forward the decades, and now you're in your mid-40s. We got so much going on, all right? And I'm just trying to talk to people like, you know, who are listening, like real people, right? I mean, look, you got your spouse to worry about. You got stressors with your family life. You got your kids to worry about. You got your mortgage. You got your job to worry about, your boss. You got your car payments. And then, oh, by the way, if you follow anything in the news, we're worried about the election, worried about the war, worried about, you know, what kind of sickness is going on. Look, there's a lot of stressors going on, okay? And those stressors make it really hard for us to focus on making good decisions of the food we choose, quality food. Those distractions make it very difficult to eat smaller quantities, smaller portions. In fact, they're so stressed out, we eat a lot. Those distractions make it hard to exercise and stay active. Those stresses prevent us from getting good quality sleep, which interferes with our metabolism. So it's not that our fate is hardwired in our body. And when you hit 45, that's it, baby, you're screwed. No, the reality is that we got a lot going on. So we have to sort of tease apart some of the things that are going on and start to just calm down a little bit and make some of the good decisions starting one by one that can help our body reset to the metabolism, to the fat, to the hormonal interactions that our body needs to give us energy, to give us the shape that we want to have, and to be able to allow us to live and thrive as we get older.
Yes, thank you for that very comprehensive, detailed explanation. I think everybody probably got a lot out of that. And really the way you're describing it is that the communication has completely gone offline because of your current metabolic condition. And there are things that you can do to restore proper communication, right? I always say hormones are the communicators, and you can get them reestablished. I love intermittent fasting and exercise and many of the other things that you shared. Thank you so much for sharing this wisdom with everyone. You make it sound very approachable and doable by almost anyone, which it is. And so I love that. We'll definitely have links to your books in the show notes. You have a wonderful Dr. Lee's Friday 5 handout, which we'll have a link to in the show notes. You want to tell them a little bit about that and where else they can find you online?
Yeah, well, listen, my mission is to get good information about people's bodies and how food interacts with them in a joyful way. That's my mission, is to really impact as many lives as possible. So I have a website, drwilliamlee.com. Please come to visit my website, take a look at the information that's on it. My books, Eat to Beat Disease, you can buy them anywhere books are sold. You can order them online very, very easily. I do courses. I have online courses you can find on my website. I run them every month. And this is a deep dive into your body and the foods that can activate your body in ways that are delicious and effective, so that you don't have to fear your food. You can love your food and love your health at the same time. And I put out newsletters. These are free newsletters that just contain facts and information. And, you know, I'm inundated with information all the time. I want to do the heavy lifting for the public, for you guys who are listening. I'll try to, you know, bury the stuff that's BS, and I'll try to surface the stuff that's really useful that you should know. The difference between medical research involving drug development and biotech and pharmaceuticals is that, you know, even if you hear about that stuff, you can't do anything about it, most of the people in the public. But for food as medicine research, when there's something important, there is immediacy. I told you that eating, you might be surprised, soy foods like edamame or tofu can lower the risk of breast cancer, or tomatoes can lower the risk of prostate cancer if you're a man. Hey, guess what? That is something that after you hear that, you can make a decision right away, lickety split, to add something good to your health. And so please, I welcome people to my community. I've been teaching these online courses. We've got thousands of people from more than 80 countries that have taken my course. And so I just love the idea of trying to create as much impact as possible. And thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. And thank you for listening to another episode of The Hormone Prescription with Dr. Kieran. I know you have loved today's episode. I know you're going to add strawberries to your diet. I know you're going to add tomatoes. I know you're going to look at Dr. Lee's books and read them and get some powerful information, maybe join one of his courses. And really, your most powerful tool when it comes to your health and your hormones is the food that you put in your mouth. I cannot say that. You literally are what you eat. Your hormones are what you eat. You are what you eat. So this is the most powerful tool that you have at your disposal to make powerful changes in your health for this year. Like I said, 2024 is the year of self-love. So do it right. Make it an action. It is a verb. Take the actions that will get you where you want to be. Thanks so much for joining us. And until next week, peace, love, and hormones, y'all.
Thank you so much for listening. I know that incredible vitality occurs for women over 40 when we learn to speak hormone and balance these vital regulators to create the health and the life that we deserve. If you're enjoying this podcast, I'd love it if you'd give me a review and subscribe. It really does help this podcast out so much. You can visit thehormoneprescription.com, where we have some free gifts for you, and you can sign up to have a hormone evaluation with me on the podcast to gain clarity into your personal situation. Until next time, remember, take small steps each day to balance your hormones and watch the wonderful changes in your health that begin to unfold for you. Talk to you soon.